Hey, fellow Montrezl Harrell stands. Welcome to Luxury Tax, the only podcast where illegal streaming is readily encouraged. I'm Logan.
And I'm Maxwell. You can catch us here every Wednesday on the Lead Sports Media, as well as the Spotify and Anchor app. Well, salutations to my Homo sapiens, my Neanderthals, my Denisovans. I don't care if you're a biped or a quadruped. We are absolutely overjoyed to have you here at Luxury Tax. Logan, are you adequately slizzard from your boat ride earlier today?
Oh, absolutely. And I just watched Anfernee Simons drop 15 points in the first quarter of a summer league on a perfect 5-of-5 from deep. So as
Jesus,
the great Jordan Belford would say, I'm jacked to the tits.
I do not recall said quotation. However, I find it particularly compelling that everything I've seen from Anfernee Simons, whether it be last year's 82nd game liftoff of 37 points, some of the summer workouts he did with Nasir Little and Courtney Lee, 5 runs, and then the summer league game, you know, it seems like he's putting it all together in terms of the prospect we wanted him to be. Yet we haven't seen anything in terms of him putting on a show against real NBA competition.
Yeah, and we're going to see a little of that this year coming up. And obviously, he still has a long ways to go. I mean, he was the youngest player in the draft last year. He was still 18, so we still got 2.5 more years before his 21st birthday. We could be talking about a guy that development curve is just going to be through the roof and is almost going to fill Dame's shoes once he kind of pops out of his prime here in a couple of years.
Oh, Dame will be Dame till he's 40.
I don't know about that.
It will be a truly sad day when Damian Lillard loses his touch, because he just feels like the player who should play forever. We at Luxury Tax, as much as the focus groups that we put together suggested that we should spend another 40 to 45 minutes speaking on behalf of Anfernee Simons, we do have to pivot a bit to the absolute grotesque trade that occurred this past week involving the Kawhi Leonard and Paul George and the Clippers and Thunder, respectively. Logan, what was your immediate reaction? Because mine was, in fact, wrong.
Mine was, damn, that's a lot of picks.
Right.
And then, wow, the Clippers are going to be really fucking good.
Yeah, mine echoed that shape a little bit, but What the information that I ignored that was crucial immediately as it came out was these are not lottery picks. You know, the sheer quantity of 5 picks seems like, you know, is this radioactive decay. But
and don't forget about the pick swaps as well.
I mean looking at this trade, if I'm fucking Steve Ballmer in that room with Doc Rivers and whoever the hell, I'm sitting on that phone and I'm saying, you can have our pick swaps until 2075. You can have our pick swaps until we're living under a biodome, as far as I'm concerned. You know, like, the pick swaps are the least of the worries.
I think Steve Ballmer just said, have our picks till I'm dead. That's how it's
You know what? And I was imagining Steve Ballmer trying to maybe orchestrate this thing. And I thought the beautiful thing as it pertains to this trade, but the beautiful thing about an NBA franchise as a business in general is you don't have to go and craft some mission statement that pleases all different parties, both politically and humanitarian wise, you know, to like cover up the fact that you're, you know, almost singularly motivated by profit margin. As a basketball franchise, you can get in that room when Kawhi Leonard calls you and he said, I need Paul George, let's make this happen. And you can look at what your bottom line as a basketball franchise is, and it's, can we win a goddamn championship? Or else, what are we doing here? You know, and I think fundamentally, that's got to be the logos that formulated this entire thing. It's, I don't care how many picks, I don't care how good Shai Gilgeous looked in the pick and roll last year, I don't care how many years Gaio has been here shooting a good percentage. You know, when it, this is a once in a generation move. None of, what are the odds that any of these picks is going to turn into Paul George or Kawhi Leonard? Slim to goddamn none, right?
Astronomically low. And I think what we've seen this year with free agency is just a total disintegration of this illusion of loyalty that was kind of clinging in the clouds of the NBA circles for a while. Is, oh, DeMar DeRozan was so loyal to the Raptors last year. How could they do this to him? NBA front offices aren't even masquerading as loyal anymore. They're loyal as much as it can until they want to win.
Right.
It is players that possess loyalty more so than anything. And even Kemba Walker said enough of that. I just want to go win a ring, or I want to have a chance of competing. You know, loyalty is absolutely dead as in regards to the NBA now. There's no loyalty.
Well, I think, I mean, if you look at a situation like, you know, Kemba and Kyrie, who both at times actually vocally pronounced that they intended on staying, the truth is that we have arrived at a league where it's nothing like the MLB, where the front offices are playing money ball games with numbers and, you know, pocket protectors. It's nothing like the NFL, which is, you know, still... you know, still dwelling and entrenched in a pseudo plantation model of business, which is pretty difficult and offensive to talk about, where Antonio Brown makes about as much as Jeremy Lamb. The truth is that in the NBA, the modern NBA, the players, the superstars are the captains of the goddamn ship. You know, Zion Williamson has not played an NBA game yet, and he can call the shots for that entire organization. And that's just the truth, you know. And I think Kawhi's a smart guy, and he understands the league's trajectory and where the power grids are kind of manifesting themselves. And I think he was like, you know what? I'm Kawhi Leonard. I just beat the Warriors. I'm not just going to go to a team for money. I'm not just going to go to a team for it's in a city I like. I'm going to go to whatever team brings me the hand-picked star I want to play with, and I'm going to make them sacrifice whatever the hell I want.
And I'm not sure if the delay on Kawhi's decision was premeditated, because in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, wait, was this strategical? Did Kawhi want the Lakers to not have any chance to sign really quality free agents, or was he just waiting on them to throw the confirmation out that the Paul George trade was in fact happening? I'm not sure.
Well, I've heard competing storylines, and I don't listen to that clowny little Abraham kid, and I don't listen to
Abraham is officially done. That wave has crashed on the beach. It ceases to exist.
And I don't listen to Broussard or any of these megalomaniacs on ESPN. I think I've heard a couple reports. I've heard that Kawhi's, you know, ultimatum was, I need Paul George. And I've also heard that his ultimatum was, I'm playing in LA, whichever team fits my bill the best, I'm going to LA. And what I'm wondering is, you know, if all he wanted was Paul George, why was it never an option in Toronto to just say, hey, look, like Lowry, you've had a fun time. Pascal, you're growing into quite the talent, but I'll stay, but I need Paul George.
I heard there was a trade on the table in which OKC was willing to give up both Westbrook and Paul George in return for Siakam and a bunch of first rounders, and Toronto said no.
Toronto said no to that.
Now, did that have to do with Toronto not wanting Westbrook? Possibly.
Yeah.
I think there's a good chance that was just the main culprit there for denying that. Was just not have one at wing Westbrook, especially alongside Kyle Lowry. Because OKC is not stupid either. They're not wanting a 32-year-old Kyle Lowry on that contract. I mean, who does?
No, and I've actually heard a couple of reports that it would kind of be a fun sort of trade for Toronto now as they slip into the mediocrity of the Eastern Conference to take on that Wiggins contract to bring Maple Jordan back to his native roots, and maybe go, you know, start to unload some pieces and try to rebuild instead of trying to compete with the Pacers. But
which is going to be tough this year for the middling Eastern Conference teams.
Agreed.
Pacers are putting together an absolute squad.
Yeah, and if the Heat end up with Russ, which we will dissect a little bit later, they could be a power player in the East. Obviously, we have no idea what Brooklyn's potential is this year, or at least I don't. You might have a foggier clue.
It's going to be a lot of running and a lot of gunning.
That is the sense I get. The other thing as far as this Kawhi trade goes, and I think it's a breath of fresh air for the league, not that Adam Silver had any sort of tampering in this, but if Kawhi goes to the Lakers, you know, I think A, they win. Straight up, they win. And it's almost irresponsible to even suggest they don't win, especially with Klay out and Durant out next year. Not only do they win, but it would almost mean less legacy-wise than the Durant championships in Golden State, in terms of you have – not only do you have three of probably the top five players of the league, each in their respective primes, LeBron near the end of his prime, but you've assembled three guys who complement each other so astronomically well, it would almost be fictitious. And like the path to them getting there, like none of them are drafted by the Lakers and they all come in consecutive seasons. I think Kawhi looked at it. I don't think he's, you know, wrapped in his ego at all, but I think he looked at it as this would just diminish what I've done in my career. You know, this is a legacy move.
Yeah. And it's not like Kawhi has played for any bad teams in his career, but when you look at the Spurs team, he won a championship with, that was the very end of the Spurs dynasty in which you had like a 35, 36-year-old Tim Duncan, Parker and Ginobili both using, like, walkers to get off the court by the end of the game. Like, Kawhi can't.
That's not fair.
But
Parker had a good year last year. I'm not even going to lie to you, before he retired.
Yeah, I mean, averaged, like, 9 points a game on good splits. Sure, like, he was the Hornets, like, second-best player. Actually, third behind Jeremy.
I was the Hornets' second-best player last year.
But my point is that Kawhi is yet to play for a true super team. And, well, he's been on some pretty ridiculously good rosters. He hasn't gone to the level of, I'm going to take my talents to South Beach, right? Or I'm going to...
Correct. Yeah.
So, I think there's something to be said for that and just how Kawhi operates in terms of, I want to win a championship with a third team and be the first player ever to win a championship in three different cities and win a championship for the team that I grew up loving. So I definitely think that Clippers were his first choice all along, but it all came down to who's going to, like you said, who's going to deliver me PG on the table and how can we make this work contractually wise?
Oh, absolutely. And now, looking at this Clippers roster that he's inherited, it's Shai Gilgeous-Alexander-less, it's absent Gallo, but I mean, I've been checking this thing out top to bottom, kind of tinkering and toying with the different, you know, big and small rosters they could pull. This thing's loaded. Defensively, it's goddamn loaded. The perimeter defense will be suffocating to a crippling degree. It's terrifying. Do you like this roster in terms of competing and contending in the West?
Oh, yeah. You have just three of the just top defensive competitors in the entire NBA starting for you at the Staples Center next year, and Patrick Beverley, Paul George, and Kawhi. And as like eccentric and erratic of a person as Patrick Beverley is, I think him and Kawhi could really get along. Like, they could pull like a Mirotić and Bobby Portis just butting heads, a little haymaker action. But at the same time, I think they could absolutely get along, just both with that pathological desire to compete. Now, Beverly's a little more outspoken than Kawhi, obviously, but I think Kawhi gets along with anyone who wants to win. And he's kind of that very quiet, subtle leader that leads by example. And everyone on the team just looks up to him because he knows how to win. And I don't know if there's a better leader than that, because you're not going to have locker room issues with Kawhi, but you're going to have a guy that goes hard every fucking day in practice and everyone's going to look up to, and I need to get on his level. Like, what is Kawhi doing? I'm going to follow that.
Absolutely. And I mean, so I do think his quiet presence is something that I think, even if Kawhi maybe doesn't get along with the guy on the team, doesn't necessarily gel or vibe with somebody, I think he's assessed his priorities at this point in his career, where he just keeps it to himself and focuses. Like, yeah, I don't see a Mirotić Bobby Portis situation going down. But so we look at this starting lineup right now, and the starting lineup that I project is going to be Beverly, and then they'll probably start Shamet, so Lou Will can come off the bench again. They dropped Tyrone Wallace, who Minnesota just picked up. So it'll be Paul George, Kawhi, and then presumptuously Zubats is how you say it.
Mm-hmm.
Who the Lakers got rid of for two slabs of tinfoil last year, if I'm not correct.
And Mike Muscala, is he the two slabs of tinfoil you're referring to?
Yeah, that's and I it's just weird, because I feel like even Lakers fans were convinced that Zubac had, you know, some sort of potential as maybe not a starting big, but just a guy who can go in there, finesse, bang a little bit, good pick and roll finisher. But he had a great end of the year splits with him and Harrell just going body on the glass. Do you think he is the big guy that Paul George and Kawhi want to play with going into the playoffs?
No, probably not. And what we've seen historically, at least in the last like 2 to 3 years, in terms of teams that have made deep runs in the playoffs, it's guys that have centers like Zubac that will proceed to play them for like the roles will be relegated into like 15 minutes a game and then replaced by like a Montrez, who is ideal for playoff minutes alongside George and Kawhi.
Yeah.
And kind of eats up those minutes at center, 25 to 30 a game, just giving it his all. And yeah, I think Zubac and Montrez's minutes will kind of be staggered throughout the regular season. But once the playoffs hit next season, assuming everyone stays healthy, I think we're going to see many more Montrez minutes than we are Zubac minutes. Assuming Zubac just doesn't take a huge step this year, like develop some kind of outside perimeter game. I mean, barring that.
Yeah, and we're definitely both just like absolutely monstrous in our enthusiasm for all things Montrez Harrell. And if anything, I'd say Montrez Harrell's best comp in the league, other than like 2013 Kenneth Faried, is probably the Julius Randle on the Lakers.
Yeah.
I guess what I'm curious about with a guy like him is you're watching a Clippers team, you know, you see Montrezl Harrell go in, you watch 10 minutes, and you just see him just absolutely decapitate the opposition for a good, you know, 6 minutes and then go back out. You know, he'll have like 12 points and 8 rebounds in 6 minutes. And you think to yourself, or at least me, I think to myself, why is it that Montrezl Harrell cannot play this whole goddamn basketball game and be, you know, an all NBA caliber player? And I wonder what it is about him that prevents him from, you know, being a starting caliber player.
I think it's the same thing that prevents Lou Will from starting, is they just feel more comfortable in that consolidated in that bench role.
You think it's a feel thing?
I think it's absolutely a feel thing. And okay. I think part of it has to do with the fact that second unit bigs have a tendency to be a little bit less aggressive, be a little smaller.
Yeah.
Kind of disappear sometimes. And so Montrez just capitalizes on that by being like the antagonist of the like less aggressive big that a lot of second units have in the NBA. And I think he just loves going in there and being like, I am your daddy. Like, I'm going to destroy you. And him and Lou Will, like arguably the two best six men in the entire league on the same bench unit, is just absolutely terrifying, especially when you just got knocked around by Paul George and Kawhi. Oh, now we go against the best bench unit in the NBA. Like,
oh, yeah. And
it's just going to be demoralizing for teams to have to face that.
I mean, and it's not just Trez and Lou Will. I mean, if you're a Clippers fan, I mean, if you're a Clippers fan back when Donald Sterling was running the franchise into the ground, I mean, you have to be just shaking your head at the luck of how shrewd and calculating this franchise has gone and amassed assets. I mean, Jerome Robinson, a good player, can play. Rodney Magruder, who's probably going to be on the third unit for the Clippers this year, was at times like the best scoring option the Miami Heat had last year. You know, Rodney Magruder, if I'm not mistaken, started like 50 games for the Miami Heat last year and was proficient shooting splits, a great perimeter defender, really ran out in transition. He'll barely play. Much less how much I love Terrence Mann and Kevin Gelly as first round draft picks. Like, this team is goddamn loaded.
Yeah, loaded in everything except for draft picks, but you're really banking on, we have this 3 to 4 year window here where just prime two of the best perimeter defenders in the entire NBA and Kawhi and PG. Montrez still entering his prime. Lou, his prime will go until he's dead. Like,
right.
So did you totally eradicate the future of your franchise? Possibly. But you still have a lot of young assets that if things somehow go south, you can still salvage something. But I don't think they're going to have to worry about that.
Dude, we didn't even touch on Jamichael Green re-signing for way below his market value. Mo Harkless, who's been, you know, a prominent part of very successful Portland Trailblazers lineups, another strong perimeter defender. You know, like, mm-hmm. they have 4 to 5 veteran-level, clear-cut NBA-caliber players on their bench who, if somebody goes down, if Zubac isn't getting it done, they can go small with Harkless or Magruder or Jerome Robinson. Thornwell's not a terrible player. You know, like, I it's just really hard for me to find any significant holes in this team outside of Patrick Beverley's playmaking isn't NBA elite, but it's strong. The fact that Paul George and Kawhi aren't excellent passers is a question mark in terms of their overall offensive flow and playmaking. But I think it's a damn good roster.
It's a damn good roster. Now, I do want to transition to what the Lakers' reaction to this is, because as soon as this news dropped, July 5th, within like 15 minutes, the Lakers were just going on an absolute tear of handing out 2-year contracts to Danny Green, to KCP, Quinn Cook, Rondo, JaVale, DeMarcus Cousins, Caruso, Troy Daniels. I mean, they just, in about 12 hours, I think, handed out their entire remaining cap space to about 6 or 7 guys there. And, oh, not to mention they just signed Avery Bradley as well. But what do you think about what the Lakers did in terms of roster assimilation alongside this LeBron AD core, and
yeah,
how that's going to play out in terms of the matchup with the Clippers?
Yeah, so I'll start with the really crucial signing, which was the Danny Green 2-year for $30 for Grant Danny Green, coming into his kind of elderly prime, is a bit much of money. However, if the Lakers didn't sign Danny Green, they would be utterly horse fucked. And I think they knew that. and I think that played a pretty pivotal role in the negotiations, as they probably spiraled from like 2-year $20 to 2-year $30. The Danny Green was absolutely essential in keeping the Lakers, you know, competent in terms of playoff contending, because you can throw in KCP, you can throw in Caruso, you can throw in whoever the hell you want during the regular season. But Danny Green is a playoff basketball player, and he's shown it again and again that he can defend at an elite level in the perimeter in the playoffs and shoot from the baseline proficiently. There were other moves I liked. I like Avery Bradley as, again, like a defensive stalwart going into March. I like I actually do like Caruso, although I wonder, I don't know. I've only seen Caruso in either garbage time or like end of the season sort of like meaningless games where he's playing alongside like Tyler Ennis and what's the kid from Gonzaga's name? Perkins. So
Jonathan Williams.
yeah, no, yeah, sorry, Williams. I haven't seen Caruso in lineups where he's actually playing with really elite talent. Okay. Now, JaVale and Boogie to me seems just demonstrably redundant, especially when you're paying them both real money. I don't mean mid-level exemptions. I don't mean veteran minimum. You're paying JaVale a real NBA salary, as well as that Boogie 1 year 3.5 minute 3.5. That was a little iffy to me. They paid Rondo, right?
They did pay Rondo. He was on the minimum.
They paid Rondo on the minimum, and so we're just assuming that Rajon Rondo is your starting point guard for the Lakers this year. Is that correct?
No, the report came out yesterday that LeBron will be starting at point guard for the Lakers next year.
Well, LeBron is a different species of superhuman, so I have no blanket criticism for that yet, but there has to be a year where LeBron cannot play 80 games of playmaking and initiating and scoring and rebounding and carrying a team.
I
Like there.
think the angle here is AD is going to be our main scorer on this team. I think they're gonna be like, LeBron's going to give the ball to AD. AD's going to drop 30 a game. LeBron's going to facilitate, run the offense. Rondo's going to relieve some stress off the bench once in a while. But I'm still concerned with just the perimeter game for the Lakers. I mean, yes, you added Danny Green, but he's not a volume 3-point shooter to the extent that like what LeBron had in Cleveland when you had like J.R. Smith and Korver and all those guys back on the 2016 team when they came back from that 3-1 deficit. I mean, you KCP isn't an outstanding 3-point shooter. He can kind of fill it, but nobody on this roster, aside from Danny Green, is really just like a marksman from three. And I think that's a little concerning going forward for the Lakers. Now, who's to say they don't make a deal at the deadline for just a guy like, I mean, they could get Korver, obviously. He's still deciding between the Bucks, the Sixers, and the Lakers. But you could definitely see them make a move for like Joe Harris at the deadline. Or I was about to say Darren Collison, but obviously he's off practicing his new Jehovah Witness. So anyway, the Lakers are still at a deficit of 3-point shooting, and they need to find something within the offense that is going to take some stress off of LeBron and AD, especially when AD and LeBron are probably going to sit out back to backs. I doubt that the Lakers are going to be like a 60-win team this year.
Yeah, no, I can definitely see them kind of being a bit lethargic with regular season back-to-backs. I think it'll be showing up for big games and maybe dropping a 19-point loss at home to the Magic every once in a while. I think when you're talking about how are the Lakers going to compete in terms of perimeter shooting and just perimeter shot creation on offense. I mean, when Pelinka got on the phone with David Griffin in New Orleans and, they went back and forth, I'm sure Ingram versus Kuzma came up a lot. And I think if you're Pelinka, you said, listen, I've loved how Kuzma's game has evolved throughout his time here. I love how he's become really, really aggressive with both hands, especially on that kind of below the arc, starting below the arc. Diagonal sort of drives that are finishing with both hands. And I think what you're betting on with Palinka is Kuzma can get from 31 to like 37% from three and become not just a proficient shooter, but a gravity shooter. And what that's what the Lakers really need is a gravity shooter, somebody that you just simply cannot help off to create the space and minimize the double teams on Anthony Davis and LeBron. I think Kuzma can get there. I really do. I'm a believer in Kuzma. I think he works his ass off. I think he's liked by everybody. I think Pelinka is betting on Kuzma to get there. I'm not sure that KCP can recreate the shooting splits he put up with the Pistons. I don't know if Danny Green is a little bit past his prime yet, but I believe in Kuzma.
And you also have Troy Daniels, who is slowly,
underrated.
One of the better three-point shooters in the entire league in terms of three-point percentage. He is a career 40% three-point shooter.
I looked at that stat, and that stat read the same way the Tyus Jones had the best assist to turnover ratio in the league last year read. It just felt like a weird product of happenstance instead of a reflection of actual ability, but I could be dead fucking wrong.
I mean, Troy Daniels had a year, it was 2015, where he shot 48% from three on three attempts per game. 48%.
Yeah, that's lethal. That's lethal.
So, like, can he do anything else besides shooting? No. I mean, when we talk about, oh, this guy's a shooter, we're not even talking about that. We're talking about Troy Daniels is nothing but a shooter. As in, he stands at the three-point line, he makes it 4 out of 10 times, and that's all he does.
And that might be the recipe for success for the Lakers.
Yeah, we'll see.
But I mean, this Lakers—it's a work in progress. The last question I wanna drive home on the Lakers is: do you like the Boogie signing? Do you think it brings any value, or do you think the Achilles basically just washed Boogie's career?
I think when these injuries oftentimes happen, it is the second year post-injury that you really find out if a player is going to recover from it.
Yeah.
I mean, you remember, actually you don't remember, we were not alive, but when Dominique Wilkins went down with that awful Achilles injury.
Oh no, I recall, yeah.
And that was before, you know, medicine had advanced the level it is now. And Dominique Wilkins came back and he was just extensively better than he was pre-Achilles injury. And that was that was like late prime too for Dominique, which was the area we're in with DeMarcus too. Now, weight is also a concern with Boogie, because if you saw him post Achilles this year, he was chugging along with an extra like 20 pounds. I mean, he was just pounding
home. Dude's got some love on
the
his
chicken
bones.
And cornbread. Oh my God. Like,
yeah,
it's not the Draymond situation where you put on 20 throughout the regular season, then like magic kind of throws you an elbow. Hey, you should lose some weight. Oh, he loses 20 weight for the like playoffs and is all of a sudden a top 10 player in the league again for the playoffs. But yeah, the weight concern is definitely there with Boogie and just the desire to really get better. I'm not sure if that's there with Boogie, but definitely a chance to redeem himself and win a ring after he obviously went ring chasing this offseason, hoping to obtain an easy ring and then get a max contract. And I wonder if he's going to have a little bit of a chip on his shoulder after this, thinking, okay, I didn't win my ring. I'm practically on a vet minimum. And I just tore my Achilles. You know? I wonder if that's going to drive him to be even if he's a shell of the player that he once was and still maintains offensive efficiency and isn't just a complete negative on defense, that's still a very good contract for the Lakers.
Yeah, no. Financially, it's just a prove it sort of deal. Like, show us what you got. I guess like my thing with Boogie went to the Warriors and he was thinking, here's my rehab ring. I just get to, you know, I just get to chill out, chug my way to, you know, maybe an 80 win season or some bullshit. And what ends up happening is he gets, you know, thoroughly decompressed and exposed for his atrocious pick and roll defense in the finals. You know, Kyle Lowry just undresses him again and again with the pump fakes and floaters. And I mean, Marc Gasol, not a particularly aggressive nor athletically gifted man, was bodying the hell out of him and elevating above him for rebounds. I mean, I think this finals was the low point of Boogie's career, to be honest. I mean, the fans who are watching him on defense. And what's so heartbreaking about that was, if you remember Boogie pre-injury, it was when Anthony Davis was down and it was right after like the All-Star break where Anthony Davis and Boogie played a pretty good dual big season up until then. Anthony Davis goes down and Boogie just carries that team. I mean, Boogie was putting up like there were stat lines. It was like 38, 12, and 8. I think like 38, 12, and 8, 40, 15, and 9. I mean, there was, I think for a couple of months, Boogie was averaging like 8 assists a game.
Oh, it was ridiculous.
Yeah, on a Pelicans team that was not particularly talented and relying mostly on Etuan Moore's three-point shot for any sort of spacing, he was going off. So, you know, to see that guy decimated to what we saw in the finals is, you know, it's heartbreaking. But, you know, part of me still believes that for 3.5 mil and one year later, you know, it might be the magic mix. It might be the perfect timetable.
I mean, yeah, this is really it for me. He is backed into a corner here. It's do or die. It's you have one last chance to prove that, like, you have something left in the tank, and you're not even going to get salvage of that minimum after the 2 years of this if you cannot show us that you can perform at a high level. So
right.
We'll see if he has it in him. I think he does. I want to think he does. As like one of the most offensively talented bigs for a good portion of this decade,
yeah,
I think he can return, salvage some kind of that form, and be productive for this Lakers team.
All right. Well, enough of Boogie. The question I really want to ask you is, if you're Sam Presti, right, and Paul George proverbially storms into your office, he probably didn't. He probably, you know, sent him a Snapchat, whatever the hell Paul George does communicatively, or has his agent or secretary send him a Snapchat. If you're Sam Presti and you get that directed from Paul George, look, I want to make it happen. I want out. Do you call his bluff? Do you do what Presti did? Do you demand that Bulmer also give you Montrez and 8 more picks, Lou Williams? What do you do if you're Sam Presti?
I think he could have gotten even more.
I totally agree. I'm with you. I think, oh my God.
Like, as much as he got, I think you could have also asked him to throw in Montrez, and I think they would have said yes.
I do too. Even though five first round picks and the pick swaps is probably the biggest bag we've ever seen in terms of like a top and, 10 player trade.
And Gallo and Shai. We're talking about,
yeah,
a guy in Gallo who was a fringe all-star for like 4 years in his prime.
Right.
And one of the most promising like rookie guards in Shai. Well, probably second to like Trey in terms of that rookie guard class last year.
Right. But if you're sitting there, Sam Presti, and you know, hey, like the Clippers right now have a chance to get 3 of the top 5 players in the league, you know, like what, I think you got to be asking, what are they not willing to give up? Can we just buy like the real estate rights to your stadium? Like, you know, it's like, at what point are they actually going to say no? And really, if I'm Sam Presti, my question is, at what point can I ascertain enough value that I don't have to go into tank mode and still give up Paul George? And to me, in that endeavor, he utterly failed because he just gave away Jerami Grant for a Denver Nuggets probably number 30 first round pick.
And I cannot emphasize enough how much of just a sheer highway robbery this trade was.
Oh, that was decrepit. That was, I mean, oh my God.
We're talking about one of
that was a stain.
The premier two-way wings in the entire NBA was one of the main reasons that OKC was as good as they were last year, aside from, you know, PG's miraculous MVP type season. But yeah, we're talking about Jeremy Gamp, who showed off a 3-point stroke as well last year, really just starting to enter his prime, still has 2 years left on his contract with a player option, right, going into 2020, 2021. And you traded that away for the 30, probably like going to end up being like anywhere from like that 27 to 30 range in the draft. You could have gotten two first rounders in that range for Jeremy Grant.
Oh, or you could have gotten, you know, some sort of quality veteran that could have maybe come in and made you respectable this year. But I mean, and I think, yeah, the Jerami Grant trade was like an obvious white flag of surrender on this season and probably indicated an inevitable move of Russ somewhere. But here's the deal. Here's the deal. I mean, the OKC fans who are coming out and saying, hey, you know, we just 76ered you guys. You know, we just – who's the 76ers who's the guy who moneyballed the 76ers into Simmons and Embiid and everybody who got fired? Who's the GM? God damn. Hinkie. Yeah, like the OKC is like, hey, we just hinkied you guys, you know? Like, you know, we're light years ahead. And I'm looking and I'm saying, who has Presti picked? You know, what is Presti's actual draft track record? Because right now, Mitch McGarry is a pro bowler. All right, 2K Ferguson might never get there. Hamidou is far from being an NBA player, you know. Like,
you took Steven Adams.
Yeah, and like Steven Adams, great pick. Okay, Harden. I guess you drafted Harden, but you botched that situation so irreparably that it's counteractive against that.
That still haunts him when he sleeps. How can he sleep?
We're not going to that debacle. That would be a three-pronged trilogy podcast. I think Simmons has already tried to do that at the Ringer. But like that's one of Simmons' biggest like calling cards is talking about the Harden, Westbrook, and Durant team. But I don't know if you can really sleep at night and not be quivering in your boots as a Thunder fan with these five picks, well, not these six picks, and believe that even one or two out of those six is going to pan out.
I mean, I think those are pretty standard odds for just a decent front office.
Yeah. No, it's tough. Yeah.
If you go 1-for-3, every third first rounder hits, and let's say like you're kind of in that middling area of the first round, like late lottery to early 20s, which OKC has often been in. If you're in that zone and one out of three of your picks hits, like even turns into a decent role player, you're doing good as a GM.
Yeah. No, that's my thing. Is like, so these OKC people, they bring up Hinkie. No, Hinkie amassed all the picks. You know, he was light years ahead. We were willing to get six wins. It doesn't matter. Here's the deal. What Hinkie did, he didn't just get first round picks. Okay, Hinkie got lottery picks. Hinkie got the picks.
High lottery picks,
right. Hinkie got the picks where you're like, hey, if we get this right, we've got a Kawhi Leonard. Like, hey, if we get this right, we've got a Joel Embiid. We've got a Ben Simmons. We've got a Paul George caliber player, right? How many guys actually in that 20 to 30 range, you know, even if they become, you know, decent NBA starters or significant role players, how many become that guy that you can build a franchise around and actually end up at the last game of the season in? The answer is not that fucking many. You know, Rudy Gobert is maybe the modern exception right now.
Jokic,
yeah. I mean, Giannis was 13. Kawhi was what?
15. Yeah. They're both 15, but yeah.
Between 15 and 20 is actually pretty big.
Oh, absolutely. And especially in this like post-Hinkie area where the lottery just got adjusted to make it the odds a lot more even. Even we're going to see a decline in the amount of just like extreme tanking going on.
Right, which is good, yeah.
Because when you see a team like the Pelicans who had like what, like the 7th or 8th best odds land Zion this year, all of a sudden you're a GM and you're like, okay, like now if we tank, we have like a 13% chance of getting like the first pick, 13% chance of getting the second pick. Like those odds are not in your favor whatsoever. No. And so you're better off just putting all your young guys on the court and implementing a system with veterans to make them better, like what it looks like the Knicks are going to do this year, and maybe land with like a 25-win season instead of like an 8-win season.
Right.
And you could still end up with the second pick or the fourth pick.
Right. And you're also hoping and betting to some extent that some of those pieces, like who the Knicks have put together, you know, Taj Gibson, Portis, Elfrid Payton, whatever, you're betting that one of those pieces is going to have some sort of existential rebirth where they just happen to be in the right position with the right coach in the right city where they can finally flourish and maximize their talents. And you start, and maybe you get your analytics guys, and you're like, hey, look, like, dude, Elfrid Payton and Julius Randle together are an absolute juggernaut of a combo, and we got to get them on the floor, you know. And you can play around, with those type of scenarios where when you have experienced NBA players with solid NBA skills. With young guys, it's like you can end up with these fucking monsoons of Dragan Bender and Josh Jackson and Isaiah Cannon lineups where it's like, not only can I not watch this, I can't get anything statistically valid from it.
Oh, yeah. And so in order for the Thunder to kind of go down this path of we're going to put our young players on the floor, we're going to use what veterans we have left to kind of serve almost as like subsidies. They're going to have to get rid of Westbrook. So that's the direction we're heading in. And what teams do you think not only Westbrook is most likely to be traded to, but what system can he fit in and be a first or maybe second fiddle and realistically make a playoff push?
Yeah, I mean, so I was talking to Vicini on Twitter about this, and he's of the opinion, as am I, that for most teams, and I mean like 90% of teams, taking on this Westbrook contract would be at best ill-advised and at worst handicapped. Now, the team that we both think has, here's the word, timeline. One, timeline. Two, expiring contracts. And three, secondary star to make it work is the Miami Heat, right? Mm-hmm. You got Butler. You know, you suppose that there's a chance in hell that Butler and Westbrook can maximize each other's potential. I'm agnostic on the issue. The thing is, you got Waiters' contract. You got Winslow. You got Dragic. And I think there's another expiring deal that you can throw in there, if I'm not forgetting. Who are the other Heat contracts?
Did Dragic get traded? I forget.
Dragic didn't get mixed into that Mavs deal. And so you at least have the Dragic and Waiters contract, which are going to get moved. And then you have three really intriguing young pieces that carry a lot of value across the league, being Harrow, Adebayo, and Winslow.
What's interesting about Hero is, I mean, he's been just having juggernaut performances throughout summer league so far. He had another like 25-7-5 today.
He's looked excellent.
He has yet to sign his rookie contract. And so the deal with the rookie contract is you cannot trade a player within 30 days of signing that. So I think what the Heat are waiting on is, number one, can we acquire Russell Westbrook? But if not, I've heard whispers of Bradley Beal still. I've heard whispers of CJ McCollum even. And so I think the Heat are kind of boiling up here, no pun intended, to just make an absolute offer for one of these like premier stars in the league. And most likely Hero is going to be included in one of those deals. Now, Miami fans won't be happy to hear that after all going on like DHgate and buying their fake Hero jerseys. But, you know, you can get your fake Miami Vice Westbrook jersey on the like reship. So it's a 30-day ship, you know, going from China.
Precisely.
You know, it'll all work out. But, yeah, I think right now it looks like Miami could be the spot for Westbrook. And how he's going to get along with Jimmy Butler, that's a different conversation. But I will say Billy Donovan is not a good head coach. And
I fully endorse said statement.
And so when you're talking about a guy with Eric Spoelstra, who's proven time and time again that can not only coach a championship team, but can also control his players and kind of alter their play styles to complement the system, I think Westbrook could really fit in nicely there and finally have a coach that understands him and he understands and is willing to sacrifice that 18-footer in the fourth quarter down the stretch instead of passing to Durant. Okay, Jimmy Butler's more efficient from the field. Let me alter my play style just a little bit to add a few more wins here. And I think we could see that with Spoelstra in Miami.
Okay, well, the thing about Eric Spoelstra, which is, you know, a truly beautiful testament to his coaching style, is he is a preacher of the gospel of something called sharing the ball and ball movement. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this concept, but it's one of the hallmarks to any sort of good artistically, you know, quality basketball. And Russell Westbrook is in fact the preacher of the lunatic rampage barreling down the court strategy, which can be in some ways in contrast to, quote, sharing the ball, end quote. Whether or not Spoelstra has any ability to persuade Westbrook in a different direction is beyond my means, but it would surely be a truly new direction for Westbrook's game. I don't know if I see it. Are there any other landing spots do you think Westbrook could logically fit into?
No, I've heard Pistons thrown up a lot. I'm not sure if Detroit actually has enough, other than, of course, picks, to even land Westbrook, being their second best player. Ish Smith was lost in free agency. I know you guys are just vomiting Drummond highlights at me right now, but
Drummond should be playing in the G League. Drummond should actually be like Drummond should be playing in the summer league right now, and then the G League. Yes. That's my opinion.
But yeah, anyway, so what you throw Thon Maker, Tony Snell, and Reggie Jackson back at OKC? Oh,
yuck. Yuck.
That's just like a heaping pile of dog
shit. Reggie Jackson already got ran out of OKC amidst like pitchforks and torches. Like, there is no way in hell that OKC is taking back Reggie Jackson. I mean, that was a non-amicable breakup.
Now Westbrook and Blake Griffin would be really goddamn fun.
I actually think that could work. Like, that just power ball could work, because they one of Blake's biggest problems is that he can't rest, and the fact that he can't rest has drained him athletically in terms of just those torpedo dunks and alley oops and just ferociousness he used to possess. He's actually become much more of a technician, because he's had to salvage a lot of his energy playing for such a god-awful Andre Drummond infatuated franchise. I actually do love the idea of Westbrook and Rose, you know, coming off for each other in substitutions. Like, teams could not rest on that. I mean, you'd get pummeled. Do you think the Hornets are an option in terms of Michael Jordan looking around his empty and paper strewn about office and being like, it appears though we may have to fill the seats. We may have to give our fans a reason to enter the arena this year.
See, the Hornets are another one is just like, what assets are you going to give up? Because you just signed Terry Rozier to a arguably overpaid contract, and maybe they're committed to him.
Generous language.
So, again, are you going to give up a 32-year-old Marvin Williams and a Nick Batum $20 million contract plus, like, 18 first-rounders? Like, what are you doing? I don't think Charlotte's a realistic option. I don't even think that Charlotte is capable of pulling that off, considering their management. I do want to talk about the Magic, though.
Yeah.
Because I've heard whispers of Orlando being semi-interested in. Orlando's a team that has been looking for offensive firepower for quite some time now.
Right.
And Aaron Gordon doesn't quite get the job done. Jonathan Isaac is still developing, though. He looked great at times last year post-All-Star break. Vucevic again. First time All-Star last year, consistent, but he's not giving you a 35-point game. He's not giving you back-to-back-to-back triple-double averaging. You're like, he's not even filling the stands there in Orlando. But if all of a sudden you get a guy like Westbrook to put alongside Jonathan Isaac, to put alongside a possibly developing Mo Bamba, will yet to be determined, to put alongside Vucevic, all of a sudden you're talking about a team that could be propelled into that like top four in the Eastern Conference realm that currently the Bucks, the Sixers, I guess the Nets and Boston now reside in.
I know I'm with you because I think logistically it makes sense for the Magic because DJ Augustin isn't getting any younger and nor is he getting any stronger at inside finishing. Listen, if I'm a GM and I'm looking at this desperation with which I think Presti is going to have to face to get rid of Russell Westbrook, if I'm a GM on a contender, I'm allergic to any of this, right? If I'm a GM on a team like the Magic, maybe, or Memphis, maybe.
Or even the Pistons.
Or even the Pistons. And I look at Wes Westbrook, and I know for a fact that it doesn't matter if Westbrook goes 1-for-15 or has a 40-point triple-double. Russell Westbrook is a spectacle, right? Russell Westbrook is an eyeball factory, you know? Like, Russell Westbrook, say what you want, he will get attention paid to your brand as a franchise because it is a truly special experience watching what he does on the floor. I mean, he is a mutant, an absolute mutant. And I, for me, that as a GM, or no, less as a GM, more as an owner in terms of just wanting my brand to prosper, like having Russell Westbrook in your organization gets you attention. It gets you money. It gets you TV. Like, it gets jersey sales. It gets people in your arena. I think that's the most, you know, coherent angle to look at this if I'm in management.
I'm so glad that you made that point because I don't think enough fans really consider that, especially small market fans or fans of these middling teams that are kind of stuck in that no man's land, that at the end of the day, this is a business. We don't have a true star. And we're trying to maximize our profits. And not every team can be the Utah Jazz. Not every team can trust the process in Philadelphia. Not every team can do that. But if you can watch Russell Westbrook for 82 games a season, you're going to get a lot of headaches. You're going to need a lot of Tylenol. But you're also going to have a really fun season watching just one of the most electrifying players we have ever seen in the NBA.
Absolutely.
Not to mention Terrence Ross is still on that team, which is fucking fabulous.
Terrence Ross is the ultimate microwave scorer and probably will be until he checks out his last minute.
You got still Markel Fultz there. You any news on Markel ever since that motorcycle accident that never got reported but definitely happened?
I have vowed and refused to spend any more of the viewership's airtime talking about the enigma and recluse that is Markel Fultz.
Fair enough.
Because the takes on Markel Fultz have tended to be so obtrusely wrong and offensively inaccurate that I don't even want our name to be infected with the Markel Fultz saga. Like, we'll leave that to whoever the hell wants to pick it up for viewership. I can't get involved. It is just too weird. It is too nonsensical, and it is too goddamn sad.
Hey, fair enough. I'm with you there.
Now, what I do want to do is pivot to something that is compellingly less sad, and that is the Summer League update with Logan Colleen. What do we have for us today?
Okay, so if you have not tuned in to one Summer League game, I'm just going to give you a quick rundown of last night's performance. Jaxson Hayes and Nikhil Alexander-Walker. Zion's not even playing.
Right.
Didn't blow out a shoe or anything. Had a minor knee bruise, I believe. He's off the floor. So thinking, oh, I'm tuning into a Pelicans-Bulls game. Maybe Kobe White will do something crafty. No. Jaxson Hayes flies out like a bat out of fucking hell. Just dunks on someone's face. All of a sudden, blocks a shot with his elbow. Oh, reverse jam? Nikhil Alexander-Walker can pass with his left hand? Oh, but he shoots with his right. What's going on here? I don't know. Is he ambidextrous? I don't know. These guys are insane. What is going on? They're like the 96 Bulls of Summer League. Watch that one game, viewers and Max. Watch that one game.
Yes.
If you're going to watch a Summer League game, okay? Aside from that, Brandon Clark had an awesome first half the other night. Just every time he freaking rotates from cross court and gets there in time for the block, it's like a new child is born. Wow, yeah. I've been watching a lot of Summer League. I think it's bad for me, but
on that Brandon Clark tangent, I was watching that game and First of all, he dunks with a viciousness and ferocity that feels third world. Like I, it's
It reminds me of Miles Bridges, but he elevates at an even more rapid pace than Bridges does.
Oh yeah, and it's a little more thunderous too, coming from his frame.
Yes.
But if you look at the way Brandon Clarke, first of all, his intuition in terms of timing on help rotations, otherworldly. Then after he solidifies his help rotation and cuts off the penetration, the shovel pass that goes into his man off the pick and roll or off the cut, he has this sixth sense of how to drop his hips and jump at the same time so as to challenge the shot at the highest point of attack, even though he tends to be a good 5 or 6 inches shorter than whatever five he's defending at the rim. And he did this, 7 or 8 times during the course of this game.
Oh yeah.
And I don't think I'd ever seen anything like it aside from when Draymond is at his absolute best. It is very Draymond-esque.
He understands defense, Brandon Clarke does, at just like a metaphysical level that very few players do.
Yeah.
I would go to the point, in the words of No Tech Ben, as could this guy be a defensive savant? Because he truly understands that end of the game more so than I've seen a rookie in a long, long time.
Yeah, no,
Now,
totally agree.
there are some other guys that have been having good performances in Summer League. Cobb and Gelly,
Yep.
we've seen a lot of him. He surprisingly is moving off ball really well, and he finds like the top of the key area on the rotation once the like secondary rotation happens, where he just has a nice little spot up. He's been shooting the ball well in Summer League. His interior defense has been great. Carson Edwards has been playing really well.
Definitely.
Jordan Poole has impressed the hell out of me.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
I don't know if the Warriors just got like an extra 2 weeks to practice, but they've been running like a ton of these Klay Thompson like curls and flares for pin downs for Poole to come around and just operate out of the top of the key. And Poole has been doing a lot of work. Like I said, Nickeil Alexander-Walker, Jackson Hayes looked really good.
Have you watched W Windler at all?
Yeah, Dylan Windler actually in the Salt Lake Summer League really impressed me. I haven't seen Windler too much in Vegas, but Windler's not afraid to shoot the ball at all. That guy will pull up from damn near half court and just absolutely fill it. I haven't seen too much in terms of playmaking from him, but he's going to get a lot of minutes this year with the Cavs.
Absolutely.
And
Well,
I like to say, before we do this outro, you need to remember to take Summer League like a grain of salt. It's fun to go on to Free Dawkins after the game and watch Anfernee Simons 52-point Cameron Artis Payne disappointing fans since 2012. It's fun to watch these guys do their thing, but just remember that this is Summer League. It's possibly even a step down from the G League. These guys have maybe a week's worth of practice before going in. They're very raw. There are no systems in place. So whatever you see, it's nice, but we got the regular season right over the corner. So a lot of your opinions, don't let them be shaped now. But enjoy Summer League, what we have left of it.
Well, that was an eloquent disclaimer, and I'm with you 100%. And that's been our Summer League update with Logan Colleen.
Yes, sir.
We will be back. We will be back next week with whatever explosive material finds its way onto your Twitter timeline and into our hearts. Thanks for listening, and have a great week.
Thanks for tuning in to Luxury Tax. For more scalding hot takes, don't forget to follow our Twitter at The Luxury Tax, as well as the Lead Sports Media.
That's right. And tune in next week, Wednesday, for our newest installment. And make sure to keep those elbows in check at your local YMCA tomorrow. Adios, y'all.